ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When I think about where design sits in Australia today, I inevitably reflect on how it has evolved and on the individuals who've shaped that evolution. One of the most influential figures in that story is here with me in the studio today. Mary Featherston, AM, has helped us reimagine design as something deeply human-centred, something embedded within the environments we inhabit, rather than confined to individual objects. Her work has fundamentally expanded our understanding of the role the environment plays in education. And alongside her husband, Grant Featherston, she contributed to defining a distinctly Australian mid-century modern design language, one that thoughtfully blends international modernist ideas with life in Australia. You know that question, who would you invite to a dinner party if you could choose anyone? Well, Mary Featherston would be right at the top of my list. So it's a real privilege to have her here to reflect on where design in Australia is today and where it might be heading next. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you, Anthony. It's good to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. I have to say, I'm a little bit nervous about speaking to you. I think of you as design royalty in this country.
No, no.
I thought you might say no. How does it feel wearing the mantle of such revere and such honour?
Look, it's perplexing, deeply perplexing. I just think I'm following my nose and have been doing so for decades, I think.
As we're speaking here today, Melbourne Design Week is in full swing. And I'm just wondering, how important do you think these kinds of celebrations are for us?
Well, I think that you know, you would agree that design is incredibly important in our lives because it is about making things possible. So good design, by which I think, you know, it needs to be both functional, practical and beautiful, is so life-enhancing.
So it's getting together, having the opportunity to kind of come together and talk about that and celebrate it, you know, once in a while, it's a pretty important thing to do, yeah?
And Design Week is so diverse. I mean, it's 400 different things going on.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
So actually, when you think about that diversity, is there anything in particular that excites you at the moment?
Really, at this stage of my life, I'm a bit remote from what you would say would be classically regarded as design because I've become more of an activist, really.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So you don't think of yourself as a designer as much as an activist these days?
I think I've shifted over the years. Because of the sort of work I've been doing, it's gradually shifted from a real focus on design and the role of design, particularly the role of design in social change.
At one point in an interview, I heard you say, design can't change the world, but it can help.
Yes.
It's a modest but an incredibly powerful statement to make, actually. So I wondered if you could sort of unpack that a little bit. Who can design help and how does it help?
Well, I think it can help everybody. And I think that perhaps what was going on in mid-century modern design when I was young and learning was that design was for everybody all the time. I worry that design can be pushed into a niche where it's just for some people at some times rather than something that applies universally.
You mentioned beauty there a moment ago and how important that is. That's a topic I'm fascinated with these days because it seems like it gets very easily pigeonholed in all the wrong ways. Can you kind of expand a little bit on what beauty really means to you? I know, it's a big one, isn't it?
What a question. And probably it's different for everybody when I think about it, that what's beautiful to me may not be to somebody else. It's beyond decoration, isn't it? It's something that moves you, that speaks to you in some way. And certainly it's an emotional thing, but it can also be visceral.
Yeah. Do you think we have enough beauty in our lives these days?
No. I think there's too much ugliness of all kinds.
I know there's a lot of discussion around the brashness and the harshness and the pace of life and things like that. So do you think it's a kind of cultural decision that we've made, or is it more just like this is how, I don't know, the world around us has sort of positioned us in some way?
I tend to just go back to Scandinavian thinking. Back in the early 1900s, when Sweden was a very poor and agricultural and illiterate culture, a very enlightened politician decided to really look at ways to lift everybody up, not just a few. But what he did was to bring in all sorts of people, philosophers, architects, poets, all sorts of people to talk about what is that spirit that might inspire people to create a better society and a better environment. And they decided it was to do with comfort and security that people found in their own home traditionally. So what happened was that they said, well, we'll take that as the inspiration. We'll say the whole of society must have those qualities. So what happened was that it led to all sorts of design innovation, but also to the belief that everybody had the right to good design. And that led inevitably to mass production. And you can say, well, that inevitably leads to IKEA. You know, you might not say that's good design, but it made design affordable. And that's the thing that really drove Grant and I in the work that we did, was to continually look for materials and manufacturing processes that would enable us to design for quantity production. So it's that sort of thinking. It's democratic design. I guess that's what it is. Yeah.
And you've always had that as part of your ethos, your
ethic. Absolutely.
Yeah, as you say, I think it's very conspicuous in the work in the most delightful way. I suppose to think about that for a second, though, when you were designing those iconic chairs, for example, back in the 1950s, were you thinking zeitgeist or timeless?
Oh, zeitgeist, I think.
Yeah, capture the moment, yeah?
Yeah, I think so, yes. And it didn't always work, of course, because it was very experimental and we were working with different plastics technologies that, you know, hit and miss. But the one that really did work was the Numero series, which is molded resilient polyurethane foam. And we were very pleased with that because we ended up with a chair that was just three components: the molding, the cover, and a base. It was very simple and very affordable and readily manufactured. And it did well until the automotive manufacturing company that took it up realized that they'd strayed into furniture, which was not their core business, and they just pulled the rug on the whole project.
Oh.
Yeah, that okay. was the story of my life.
Yeah. At that time, as you were doing that, you said it was very experimental. Can you tell me about any, I don't know, conspicuous failures that you might have had at that moment that taught you something? I'm sure there were many, but you know what I mean? We always learn from those failures, especially in design. Anything in particular that came out of one of those failures?
I would say the stem chair was...
Oh, gorgeous, yeah.
...really pushed. That's rotationally cast polyethylene. And so it was using the same technology that was used to make crates, you know, very cheap, strong crates. So I'd have to say the wonderful thing about that time was that people were adventurous. We could take ideas to manufacturers and they would say, oh, what a good challenge, and they'd get stuck into it. So the chemist, all sorts of people on the floor, the assembly line. I don't know what it would be like now because we've lost a lot of that manufacturing capability. But it was an exciting time. And, you know, to make a big leap, it also, I feel incredibly fortunate to have been a young woman at the time of the liberation movements, when we were all questioning all sorts of assumptions in society about the way families worked, about working life. And as I've often said, being part of that has always, it's left me with the feeling that anything's possible. And it's just not true anymore.
That was exactly my next question. Do you feel like that's possible these days? And
no,
I'm hearing absolutely not.
That's why I'm here, you know, as an old activist trying to change things. It's against all the odds.
You're listening to By Design on ABC Radio National with me, Anthony Burke, and I'm with Australian designer Mary Featherston. Mary, let's talk about mid-century again. Let's keep that conversation going because a lot happened at that time, obviously. You were establishing your design identity with Grant in the furniture that you were making. You were thinking about interiors. You were in conversation with Robin Boyd about architecture, who designed your home, of course, which we'll get to in a second, I think. But when we think about that work now, we kind of have a lot of nostalgia around the 1950s and the mid-century period, even though it's super popular. But at that time, it was all adventure, wasn't it? As you were saying, even radical. you said it was all possible. Did you get a sense of radical in that moment when you and Grant were working at the beginning of your furniture enterprise, if you like, the radical bit?
Well, Grant had done a lot before I knew him. I mean, all his early work was long before I knew him. He was already established as an experimental furniture designer. And then he'd spent many years really building, with a couple of other guys, an extraordinary furniture enterprise, which really mass-produced metal frame furniture, incredibly successful. But that was, people are not aware of those designs because they were very simple. I think they're very beautiful and very affordable, but they went into the contract market in the main. So he already had all of that under his belt. But then I think we were both excited by particularly Ron Boyd's designs because they were very adventurous, very beautiful, very thoughtful. And I think that I learnt an enormous amount from that, that it's possible to create very rich, fluid spaces using simple rectilinear elements.
What was that conversation like with Robin? Was it a sort of a bump along, joyous, experimental thing? Was it more sort of hard fought between different positions?
Well, I think that Grant and Robin had worked together a lot and had a lot of mutual trust and respect. And then we worked together with the Expo chairs. So that's, we had a lot to do with Robin then. So I think that we were always in close sympathy. But Robin was always, as everybody will know, trying to alert society to things he felt needed to change. And so that took up a lot of the conversation.
Just trying to imagine the three of you sitting around and having a glass of wine or something and having these conversations on an ongoing basis, and what a kind of a heady design conversation that would be.
Yeah, but I didn't know at the time. I mean, this is the problem, isn't it, with life, that as I look back, I think, gee, that was a wonderful project and they were fabulous people to work with. You know, it's happened many times. I've been very lucky. But at the time, you think, this is it. This is the way it's going to be forever. And it isn't. You know, it's fabulous until it just
it's not.
yes. But so, you carry it with you. I guess, it keeps you hopeful.
So, look, while the design-facing community, for want of a better word, is still enamoured with mid-century design, I'm curious about how it landed at the time. I'm sure you had your critics. Was it an easy reception? Did it land in a kind of a welcome Australian context? Or was it really, like, what is this? You know, who are these people with this?
Oh, I think it depends on which part of the market, if you like, you look at. Because certainly in terms of house design, that would have been very unusual. It's only really in recent time that house design has had a shake-up. And I think that, I mean, this is a very personal view, but I just think that architecture's become so enamoured with architectural flourishes that quite often the living spaces, the interiors, are a bit forgotten.
Yeah, right. We've lost sight of what's fundamentally important.
Yeah, and I think that Robin would have hated the facadism that's going on. You know, you get a fabulous facade and you walk through and the interiors are crap.
Yeah, generic, rubbish, yeah. So, I mean, 1970s, that was an important year for you, wasn't it? A lot of things came together in that year.
Yes. Well, we had just moved into the Boyd house, which was not just a house. It was, our brief to Robin was for a space that would house our private and our work life. So it included studio, darkroom, workroom, as well as domestic spaces. But we wanted them all sort of to link together seamlessly. And that's exactly what he did, of course.
Can I quote you back to yourself here? Because I read something where you wrote that about your house that Robin designed for you. A more intimate space is being used for relaxing dining, computer-based work, and the taller space adapts for formal dining, project meetings, large-scale prototype making and photography, hot air balloon making and flying, children's large-scale block building and swinging on a 7-metre long swing. That sounds amazing.
And a hospice as well. You had to add that it was where both my mother and Grant spent the last few days, you know, time of their lives. So it has been an incredible space, really.
What an incredible brief, though. What an incredible imagination of what the space could be.
Yes. But as I say, I think that it really has, it's given me a language of space.
So coming back now to then this renewed interest or popular interest in mid-century work, what do you hope people are actually rediscovering then in that work? Do you think it's an aesthetic alone or something much deeper?
I think it's livability. I think it's that there's much more focus in mid-century houses on, we say design is important because it's about making experiences possible. And I think that mid-century houses often consider that very thoughtfully. You know, here is a nice place to sit and look out at a view or the garden and read and be quiet, or here is a space to have a noisy party. You know, it's more thoughtful design, I think. It's human-centered design more.
I think in that quote I just read out, it seems like it's the breadth of life that is encapsulated in the idea of a home that we've lost sight of.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, that not only does good design make things possible, but it can also prevent things design can make things possible, but can it also prevent things happening? So I look at a lot of, you know, interior spaces and I think, well, what could you do in there? Where would you sit comfortably? Where would you have how would you have a party there, or what does it do for kids?
This is By Design on ABC Radio National, and I'm Anthony Burke. And I'm speaking with designer Mary Featherston, and I'm discovering the intimate relationship between activism and design in her long and illustrious career. And Mary, it's time to talk a little bit now about education and your long association with what education spaces are and how we should be thinking about them. Can you kind of just give me a sense of where this started for you? At what point as an interior designer and someone who was making beautiful furniture with Grant, how did you then pivot to education?
Well, I think it was when I became a parent for the first time. Well,
that would make total sense.
Yeah, and realised I knew absolutely nothing about babies or children, nothing. So I started reading, trying to understand what this was all about. So the more I read, the more fascinated I became. And then it became time to go to school. And when I, you know, we first went through the school doors, I couldn't believe that it was so antediluvian. It was pretty much the same as I'd experienced decades ago, you know, on the other side of the world. So I've been asking the question for a long time.
What was it that shocked you the most when you think back to that moment? You go, hang on, something has to change here.
Yeah, good point. That it didn't reflect the view that I had come to about what a child was. My view was children are very curious. They like to be very active. In those early years, they're constantly moving around, experimenting, testing, discovering, making. And suddenly, none of that. You know, you're in a classroom, you sit, you comply, and you listen, and you listen, and you listen. And I was very puzzled about this.
I can't let that go without asking you, like, specifically what annoys you the most about this, the moment we're in now with education design. I mean, the system is broken. I think many people would agree with you, absolutely. But trying to put a finger on where the fix begins is a wicked problem.
I think it's both very simple and very complex. It's as simple as saying, for goodness sake, take account of what children are and how they like to be in the world and how they like to learn and how they're actually driven to make sense of their world. So that's, you know, simple. And everybody who's been around children knows that to be true, that they're highly motivated to find out. So they arrive at school with a whole lot of stuff already in their heads, lots of ideas, experiences, questions, passions from their unique lived experience. And they also arrive at school, they've already acquired a language. But then what happens when they get to school is that they're told, well, that's all very fine, but it's quite irrelevant to what you're going to do here. This is about real learning. And the worst thing, I think, is that they say, well, that stuff in your head is, a lot of it's, you know, trivial, incorrect, misconceptions. Instead of saying, wow, you know, you've got a lot already in your brain. How can we help to develop that? And, you know, sometimes children know more about things than adults do and, you know, the other way around. But it's about setting up systems, processes where everybody contributes to learning. You know, we come together as a group with a common creative project and we all bring something to that. And together, it's synergistic. We create something that's much greater than any individual.
I'm thinking about your work in 2000s in the Dandenong High School. And there you very quickly seem, to my eyes at least, seem to very quickly, as you say, brought together the idea that we weren't just designing classrooms. We were designing entire relationships between space and learning and experience, the kinds of things you've just been describing. But one of the other things that you did, and you just touched on it, was collaboration. You brought on people, the students, the teachers, the people, the stakeholders who were in the room together. These days, that kind of community consultation process that I think you were probably championing at that point, you know, it's there are good versions and there are less good versions of that. How important is that? Or do you see it happening in the right way today is probably the right question.
Look, it's something I'm grappling with at the moment. I think there are two different things. One is the collaboration is incredibly important and increasingly recognised as such. But the collaboration between kids, students and teachers is one thing, but the work that I did, we then embarked on this action research project. It was a typical design process, you know, analysing the needs, what are people actually doing and how do they want to do it, how many, for how long, all of that stuff. But that is a very detailed, sophisticated, this is sophisticated spatial organisation. And I don't think that you can do that for every project. What I'm wanting to test is whether we could arrive at some principles. If you say that this whole thing is driven by values and beliefs about children, about learning, and about the role of school in society, that's another important thing, then can we arrive at some principles that other people can work with? Because there's no shortage of great design skills. You know, there's very sophisticated design skills now, which were not available even 20 years ago, I'd say. But we need the design brief. It's not there at the moment. And in fact, I would say that, you know, the department is turning out scores that are not good for traditional use or what I anticipate they might need in the future.
You're kind of describing an ecology of experiences rather than a machine for learning.
Exactly.
And that's the flip that's necessary.
It's a big flip.
It's a huge flip indeed.
It's a big flip. But if you say collaboration, very important. So if we want the kids to collaborate, they need to see adults collaborating.
Which model means behavior.
Yeah. So you put together teams, you know, ideally three teachers, which means you've then got something like 70 kids. But you've also got the real estate of three classrooms plus the corridor. So you can then subdivide that. There's enough space to do it.
So, Mary, if you think about those principles again and those ideas, how applicable are they outside of the education space, do you think, to other areas like commercial or even the home?
Well, I think that's the one place where that, because I struggle with this. I want to be able to say, you know, it's like, and be able to refer to something that people are familiar with. The only thing I know that gets close to it is contemporary workspaces, office spaces. They're often very inviting environments that are made up of a variety of settings for people to relax, work hard, meet, you know, that you get something like the range of experiences I'm talking about within one space, and people are free to move around.
So I'm struggling now to whether I should be referring to you as a designer or an activist. Can you help me out here? What's the right moniker now?
Well, I think it's activist, but it's activist to really to encourage people, particularly parents, to consider that there are other ways to create schooling. I think that's where it starts. We've got fabulous research about curiosity, experiential learning. It's just not getting through to the coalface.
So there's more work to be done.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the project hasn't finished yet. Yeah. Well, you started off talking about your furniture and the idea of beauty there. And what I've seen happening across your wonderful design career here is that idea of beauty has now morphed into this conversation about learning and children and the ways in which we are in a space together and the best ways of doing that for these kinds of outcomes. So it's beauty written again, but in a different kind of language there, which I think is just so wonderful to hear you talk about. Mary, thank you so much for joining us on By Design.
Pleasure.
Mary Featherston, AM. Talking with Mary, she so easily communicates a real sense of the power of design to make change, but only with a genuine commitment to the essential collaborations with people, places, and environments that make up a project. From students, teachers, designers, and researchers, Mary still clearly wants to learn from us all. Her reframing of her practice from designer to advocate is really interesting and speaks to the urgency and the need for new design outcomes, but also the absolute imperative to invite everyone into the conversation if we want to get meaningful outcomes that will last through the generations. Do you have a favourite Mary Featherston design or experience? Mine is definitely the R152 contour chair from 1951. It's the definition of iconic. Let me know what yours is. Email me at bydesign@abc.net.au. Delta Goodrum and Eurovision fans, I want to point you to our Eurovision episode in case you missed it, where I speak to the design team behind her Eurovision performance this year, a performance that earned Australia a place in this year's finals. Yes, I can hear you cheering. A great reason to follow the podcast on ABC Listen or elsewhere if you are not already. Next time on By Design, why are we so fascinated with the interiors of other people's houses? I love a good sneak peek of someone's decor. How about you? That's next time on By Design, because in a rapidly changing world, design matters. The producer of By Design is Siobhan Hunt. This program was produced on Gadigal land and the lands of the Wurundjeri.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.